I would like to send out a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's supporting this podcast through Patreon, by signing up for my newsletter or membership area on Light on Conspiracies, or any other type of support. It is extremely appreciated and really helps this show to take off the way it's supposed to do. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Welcome to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Your host, Peace Award-winning researcher Ole Damagod. To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe.
Well, I figured with Bradley being out front, if he moved, I could just pop him right in the head right there. That was my plan. You did it yourself. I was all ready to go.
I'm here today with one of modern times' most important whistleblowers, in my opinion. One of the most courageous individuals I've come across, and somebody's whose name is not that well known, even though she is of extreme importance for all of us. Her name is Charlotte Thompson Isserbitt, and she has an incredible background, an incredible story, and also something of major importance to tell us. Because during her career, she was employed by the Reagan administration, and she came across the very, very malicious and dark agenda that is there put in motion to turn our children into a brainless, brain-dead workforce with no free will. So it is with incredible joy and gratitude and also admiration I welcome you to this show.
Good morning, Ollie, and good morning, or rather afternoon, I guess, for all of your listeners. Thank you very much for having me on your show. I admire and I've followed you for a while, but I never dreamed that you would contact me, because in the United States, I have been carefully isolated by not mostly the left, but the neoconservative right, Trotskyites, we call them, ever since I went into the U.S. Department of Education and blew the whistle on the major technology grant that would put the computer instruction using the Skinner method into all schools of the nation. That means all the curriculum coming from the federal level. And I saw that document and as I was working in the Reagan administration. And there was one page that said confidential. And it said, direct quote, what we can control and manipulate at the local level. And then it listed the things I was just talking about, basically. And having been a local school board member in my town of Camden, Maine, from 1976 to 1979, and fought a wicked battle due to my having just returned from 20 years overseas, I was appalled at what I saw. And so I saw a couple, you know, terrible programs coming out of what would subsequently be, without my even knowing, the United States Department of Education, Office of Educational Research and Improvement, which is connected with UNESCO and Europe and all over the world. And I didn't know at that time, innocent Charlotte, that I would be working there, but I saw these horrible programs. And one, I'll tell you, was a shocker. It was a health education program that was funded partially, I believe, by Kellogg Foundation and the state of Maine. And it called for, at least it was 12th graders, should understand the three types of sexual intercourse, including with animals. And that really blew my mind. And I knew something was terribly wrong, and I spoke out, and I had a phone call. I got a lot of phone calls from people who hated my guts, you know, in our community, who were brought into Camden, Maine to implement these dreadful programs, globalist programs. And I got this phone call from a retired teacher who had been a master teacher and had worked all over the world. And she said, hello. And I thought, oh boy, I'm going to be under attack again. And she said, I just want to thank you for the work you're doing on the school board. And I thought, I said, what am I doing, really? I don't understand. I said, I don't understand what I'm looking at. And she said, well, I want to pay for you to go for change agent training in Searsport, Maine. And I said, what's a change agent? And she said, you'll find out. And so I went, and I did find out. And it was at that in-service training, there were teachers and principals, good people. I want to make a point right here that many of our teachers in the public school system have been fighting behind closed doors a long time to keep what we're looking at right now from happening, whether it's academics or whether it's some dreadful values-destroying programs, right? So we were all there, and the facilitator came out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, University of Michigan, I think, and his name was Ronald Havelock, and the facilitator didn't come out of there, but he had this big booklet by Ronald Havelock that he used to train us in how to become change agents. And the one thing that blew me again after the first thing I just told you about was when he said that in order to get these programs in, death ed, sex ed, bullying ed, values changing, all these terrible programs our children, which sound so good to the parents, right? But he said, in order to get them in, you have to first identify the resistors in the community. And then I thought, whew, that's me. I'm being trained to identify myself. And so I could go on and on about that. I've written about all of this in my Deliberate Dumbing Down of America and Back to Basics and all the things that you probably have that are on the web. From that time on, I realized that we were at war. I had lived abroad. I had traveled through communist countries. I was stationed on Guam and in Japan during the Korean War, and then in South Africa, and then I worked for Ambassador Douglas MacArthur II, the nephew of the general in Brussels, where I met my husband. And so I had, for 20 years, right, I'd been out of the country, and I was just appalled. I thought, what has happened here? So I was on my white horse. Now the horse is very dirty, and I just kept going. And so when I got off the school board, we formed an organization called Guardians of Education for Maine, and it was a great group. And we did knock the health education, in quotes, out of half the school districts in the state of Maine. Well, due to my activity, my activism, being a resistor, I was pulled down to work in the Reagan administration. I had a friend who was in White House personnel, and I think it was, you know, so I say the hand of God, because how on earth would little Charlotte, without any credentials whatsoever, be placed in the position that I was placed in, which was senior policy advisor in the Office of Educational Research and Improvement? Well, the only reason I was put there was Reagan had promised to get rid of the Department of Education. So we were meant to go in there and pull the building down. Well, that didn't happen. So I just happened to be, I was like a child in a candy factory. I was sitting there with all the old documents from the, you know, the president of the University of Chicago, Stanford, Harvard, whatever. The guys that had been in that job prior to little Charlotte being put in there simply because I fell into that slot miraculously, right? And so I had access to all of the old plans, which would be pre-1980, and all the new plans, which include exactly what we're looking at today. the charter schools, the school choice agenda, the school to work, the agreements with all of the foreign countries, the technology materials. I'm extraordinary. Some of the career educators there were very good, and they gave me present documents because I was looking through the old stuff. They gave me very, very important documents that they were bringing out of Europe. That one of them was our representative to UNESCO, and he funneled stuff through to me even after I got myself fired. Career people in the Department of Education funneled very important documents through to me after I was fired. Now, what happened was I got myself fired because I saw this document that proved that the computers were the technology, the curriculum and all were going to be going out from Washington with strings attached, of course, money for all the schools in the nation. And so I thought, well, before I do leak it, I leaked it to Human Events that used to be a very good, truly conservative journal. We had a good conservative movement in the United States prior to Ronald Reagan being elected. It was pretty good. It was getting a little lame, but it was pretty good. So I got all the documents out and into my apartment. And actually, many of them are at my son's website, AmericanDeception.com, and many are included in my book, which is now, it's a free PDF. Everything I have is free now, folks. Even American Deception, if you go in there, that's free. And if you have a problem getting in there, just type, you know, the password is I, and the other one, whatever it's called, is C. CI stands for me. I mean, if you want to get in there, if you have a problem getting into American Deception, just type in the user is C and the password, I guess whatever it is I. You know, so I got all that stuff out and then I was relieved of my duties, of course. And then I went home to Maine and I did a lot of traveling around the country trying to inform Americans about the change in education from academics to workforce training. And I often like to use, you know, the novelist C.S. Lewis. He put it so well, I think, when he said, when training beats education, civilization dies. And so he says a lot. Charlotte, I can't put it in so beautifully in a few words like C.S. Lewis. But anyway, I was warning and warning because I was boycotted completely by the conservatives. I wrote a little book, tiny. It's only 39 pages, I think. I've got it in front of me. It's called Back to Basics Reform or Skinnerian International Curriculum. And it's only, how many pages is it? 33 pages. No, 39 pages, okay? And it says on the cover, which I did predict, Back to Basics Reform. You can type this, folks, into your search engine. Just type Back to Basics Reform or OBE, Skinnerian International Curriculum, into your search engine, and it will pop up. It's a free PDF. Under the title, because I figured people don't like to really read anymore, I put Necessary for United States Participation in a Socialist One World Government, scheduled for the early years of the 21st century. You know, so that is exactly what we're looking at now. I think a lot of people have worked hard, including yourself, to expose this. I think they are, their schedule, they've had to postpone their date of total takeover, evil takeover, because of the work a lot of people around the world have done, not just myself. A lot of wonderful Americans who are no longer with us, brilliant, and their work is available through me, all of my documents, et cetera, and books, et cetera, and video discs, et cetera. Eight discs. It's called Exposing the Global Road to Ruin Through Education. We had a conference, two conferences on that about 4 years ago up here, one in Maine, one in Georgia, and those discs are dynamite for your listeners. And we have one disc is written submissions, which goes back, some of the finest researchers, some of the work goes back to the 50s, like in New York State, where New York State, it was called Pony, Parents of New York, in the 50s, wrote this extraordinary expose of what the new state education commissioner in New York was planning. It was it's the plan for right now, which is, in a nutshell, birth through death, workforce training. It really has very little to do, nothing almost to do with education. Using the Skinner upper conditioning, you know, he said, I could make a pigeon a high achiever by reinforcing it on a proper schedule. Well, our children aren't pigeons. And that is what we're looking at. And people can say Charlotte is off the wall, but I have a paper from the National Alliance of Business that just happened to get my hands on in the 90s, which said right on the letterhead, kindergarten through age 80, workforce training. So anyway, you know, so then I wrote Back to Basics. It was boycotted. That little book that you could easily get now was boycotted by every single conservative organization in the United States. That tells you something, doesn't it? But there are quite a few copies out there, but it's great. It's free for your listeners, and it's a lot easier than you could go to the Deliberate Dumbing Down. That's the 700 pager. I figured when Back to Basics was boycotted, so I thought, well, that's 38 pages or something. I'll write a 700 pager and I'll put all the documents in it, which is also free. That's a free PDF. Deliberate Dumbing Down of America is a free PDF. Just, you know, Google it, whatever your search engine. All of the information is there. So anyway, that's it.
Charlotte, would you mind if we go back a little bit in time so people get a background of you and a better understanding? You come from quite a high level of society where both your father and grandfather were actually part of Skull and Bones, but in a soft version, I would say. And then you had no idea about the so-called New World Order when you grew up, did you?
I didn't. I had no idea. I was totally uneducated. I even after being, I left for in 1953 during the Korean War to work for the American Red Cross during the Korean War. And I knew very little, almost nothing. In fact, I think I'd been brainwashed about Joseph McCarthy, you know, who exposed so much about the communist infiltration of the United States government. And I fell for the media's attack on him at that time. I was stupid. But then I saw in my travels, when I returned from my two-year venture with the American Red Cross, I came back on a freighter, and I was in third class, which worked out very well because it was French freighter. So, of course, we had good food and bottle of wine on the middle of the table. And there were people coming out of communist China and North Vietnam who I never forgot this. This really was the education of Charlotte in regard to what we're looking at today. And the one from China, lovely woman, she was taking her daughter to Paris, to the conservatory music there to learn piano. The mother's father or grandfather had been a very famous pianist in China, right? And when he resisted the regime, they cut his hands off. And you asked me what woke me up. Well, that sure did. And then there was a woman from Vietnam, and she told me about her grandfather, who had been the mayor or whatever of a city in Vietnam, who was opposed to the regime. And they cut his head off, and they stuck his head on a pole, and they marched around town to threaten everybody, warn them, do not resist. So when I was told at that in-service training to be a change agent, on how to identify the resistors, I immediately made that connection. And but anyway, then I kept on. I came back after I came back from I arrived back in 1956, I guess. I was abroad from 53 to 56. And I stayed with my family a while. And then my father, who you referred to as being, you know, a member of the order at Yale, he, a wonderful man. He'd been mayor of several towns on Long Island, New York, and was involved in New Jersey as well, elected official at the local level. It was interesting how somebody who could be a member of the order would have been so engaged in holding on to the United States Constitution. He was very much a constitutionalist. Of course, he did not attend all those wretched meetings either. My grandfather was extremely important. He was involved with mining in South Africa, right? And I, you know, I try not to think about what grandpa, where his beliefs came from. But anyway, so dad, I've been home about 6 months. He says, "Hey, Char, don't you think it's about time for you to move on?" And I thought, oh, gee, I've only been home, you know, for 6 months. And I thought, well, you know, he's probably right. I should. And then I thought, well, I want to go abroad. And so I thought I'll go work for the State Department. So that's how I got into the State Department. I went down and I ended up working for ambassadors. I worked, I was pretty good at shorthand. And that's always come in very handy for me. I'll tell you, the change agents hate people who can take shorthand. So I worked in the U.S. Department of State in Soviet affairs, Eastern European affairs, and Middle Eastern affairs. I worked for ambassadors. They were great. These were when we had absolutely superb experts on the Middle East. So they spoke all the languages. These were our top ambassadors that I worked for. One of them was in my wedding. I ultimately married my husband, Belgian. He came over and we were married in 1964. But they were close friends of mine, and they educated me about a lot of things. And then, of course, I got married, and we went back to Belgium, my husband and I. I spent about 4 or 5 years there. I loved it outside of Brussels, in the countryside, you know, sort of the Bruegel countryside. And then we went from Brussels is now a big hotspot, but it wasn't. Let me give you a little example of something. This is for people to hear. I never forgot this. In 1964 or 5, in Brussels, in Belgium, there was a big, bad murder. I think sort of like a whole family was taken out. And the newspaper said, and think about this in terms of what poor Belgium has now, huh? Newspaper said it was the only murder, serious murder scenario that had happened that year. So that tells you that between 1965 and the year 2017, oh my goodness, the work that has gone on in Europe. And I saw it pretty closely because that was the beginning of the common market too. And I followed that, and I followed what was going on. Of course, the Congo, Katanga, and horrible, you know, UN troops raping nuns and all the stuff going on down there. So I really was getting pretty educated, but let's move forward. So then that's pretty much my background there. You asked me about how did I figure it out? When did I figure it out? Well, this is a funny story. One day, somebody I did not know from north of Camden, from Belfast, Maine, called me. And she said, this is when I was on the school board, see? She said, Charlotte, again, another phone call from somebody who knew what was going on. I don't think you understand what's really going on. And I said, well, I don't. The same as I said to the former teacher, I'm totally confused. I've never seen anything. I never really heard that the United States was apparently under attack like this. And she said, well, I'll come down. I've got a little book for you. And she brought it down. And it was called None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen, who I did know. Dear, dear, wonderful man. God bless him, huh? And so I started to read it. I saw these names in there of families that I had been going out with these guys before I went abroad in 1953. I'd been going out with them in New York City. These were the big banking families, the big whatever you want to, really, banking, huh? And I thought, oh, wow. I mean, these are really bad people. And, you know, so I looked at my husband and I said, do you know about this? And he's Belgian. He went through a Jesuit education all the way through, which is happens to be very, you know, excellent education. But he looked at me and said, well, yeah. And I said, you know about this? And he said, yes. I said, where'd you learn that? And he said, in school. So I thought, you asked about little Charlotte's education. That's pretty much it. So I'm not going to tell you exactly how old I was when I got smart.
But that book was really a waking up point for you, it seems like.
Yeah, I woke up. I read that incredible book, and then I started reading all of the other incredible books. And now I've got so many books and all over that I don't know what to do. I really would need to buy another house, I think, and it's such a mess. And what we're looking at is just they have played us. I mean, it's been, I feel the more I know, the more I realize I don't know anything. Can you imagine how much there is out there that we don't know?
Do you know my mother, who she was born in 1930? In her older days, she said, still confused, but on a higher level.
Oh, hey, you know, your mother and I are about the same age. Huh? I think, yeah, I love that. Still confused. Oh, you know what? I got to write that down. Still confused. Tell your mother I wrote down. Still confused.
But on a higher level.
On a higher level. All right. You know what? I want to give credit to the Dutch banker who spilled the beans recently. Remember?
Yeah, it's one of my friends who interviewed him.
Well, I've been trying to get his information out. I have the highest regard for that man because everybody is so distracted by diversion. I call it deliberate diversion, right? Deliberate dumbing down, and they had to use deliberate diversion too. They keep us occupied with a lot of things that we cannot do anything about, right? While the wretched, evil, satanic, Luciferian agenda is all around us. And I mean it, all around us. And nobody's very happy here in the States. I don't think they're happy where you are. I don't know where you're operating out of, but I don't believe the Europeans are happy with what they're looking at. And my family has recently, as you probably know, been under attack. My son, who has the American Deception website, there were two attempted, and one was highly successful, murders of my son in 2000, one in October 2015, and the next one on Memorial Day in 2016, which is very appropriate since he served in the United States Marines combat during the first Gulf War. And he's a very accomplished rifleman and top notch with guns and all, right? So they tried to take him out. So I've been very involved. I try to stay on issue, which is getting the truth out to the people around the world. At the same time, we've got lawyers and we've got hospital bills. And actually, he was declared without vitals, no pulse, no oxygen at the hospital. The police didn't call for an ambulance. This was a gunshot through the femoral artery, and they didn't call for an ambulance for 22 minutes, and it was 35 minutes before he arrived at the hospital. And ordinarily, it's 15 minutes, and you bleed out. So they expected him to be dead, but he's not, and thank God Almighty, he is not. It was a miracle. But so we've been very involved, you can imagine, huge doctor's bills, legal bills, and it is a subject that nobody wants to talk about. It's amazing. We can't get any publicity. Every newspaper in this country seems to have gotten the word, don't touch this case.
You've been listening to the first hour of A Light on Conspiracies podcast. To access the second hour of this and all podcasts, please visit lightonconspiracies.com and get a membership for the price of a cup of coffee. Now, back to the show.
It is so incredible because so many truth seekers and so many that are standing up for the beautiful values in life end up with the same treatment. I mean, it's a dangerous business to get into. It's really a minefield. And so I applaud and really honor everyone who's had the courage to stand up like this. I'm just very sorry that you've had to pay such a high price.
Well, I'm a strong believer in God Almighty, Jesus Christ. I really am. And I must say, as things get worse and worse in my life, I really become much stronger. And I was thinking yesterday that why? I'm very healthy. I'm strong. My faith has increased enormously from the days I was talking to you about earlier on. I know that we're looking at very evil times, and I pray for the world, everybody. And I'm very upset with the deliberate creation of hatred amongst groups. I think having lived around the world, I got to know a lot of people from different faiths and nationalities, etc. And I can't ever remember one that I didn't get along with. And I see a deliberate, again, I could write a book on this with deliberate again, attempt to turn all of us against one another. And that's why we have the media so controlled, and it gives us nothing but horrible news, which bolsters some people who already have this hatred, right? And religious hatred towards people. And I don't like it. And I try my best to say, come on, get together, Americans, all of us together. Blacks, whites, Islam, Christian, Catholic, Jewish, all of us, we have got to stand firm. Because basically, we're all in this together. We're all going to go down together. And we have enough in common to be able to work some of these things out. As long as we don't allow the government, the globals, the Soroses of the world, the Kissingers, all of these people, to control our thinking. I may be wrong. Maybe I'm a little Pollyanna, but I remember when I worked in Middle Eastern affairs in Washington, the Egyptian press attaché was a good friend of mine. And every time we met, you know, he would start asking me questions about the United States Constitution. And he said, it's the most magnificent document that ever the world ever had. And he just went on and on. He said, every country should have that document. And so that's coming from an Egyptian, right? So I believe there are many people out there, many of your listeners and people you get through to that probably feel the same way I do. If we put, you know, just one from each country in a room, no government officials allowed, right? But all of us plain people, and we can all speak the same language, sort of. We all have different food, and because we have special food for Indians and special food for Blacks and special food for whites and whatever, you know. And we discuss what's driving us crazy. Well, we're all going to have the same answer. The government and the corporations together. Boom.
Do you know, I saw there was a group of researchers that went around the world. I think they went to about 50 different countries. And they interviewed people locally, asked them, what do you want out of life? What is your goals? What are your desires? What are your frustration? And so on. And it turned out that it didn't matter from what part of the world, what color, race, religion, 95% of what a normal human being wants is the same wherever she comes from. And then the last 5% is where religion, football, politics comes in. Otherwise than that, we set up to get along. They use this old Roman template called divide and conquer, trying to divide us all the time.
Absolutely. And I think it's so, I just wish there was more. I'm glad, you know, you feel that way. I don't hear much of that in the United States right now. I mean, Mr. Trump is a very predictable man. And if you know what I mean, and you never know, and he doesn't abide by any rules traditional rules of how government's meant to function. And I could go on, and I can understand why people voted for him, because, you know, we didn't have much of a choice. But he really does not represent America. He really doesn't. I mean, he pretends he does, but he doesn't. I have and you'll see through my work, followed the change agents' efforts to divide our country, especially through the use of the experimentation with the Black community, which is a tragic, tragic experimentation that took place. They were used. And your listeners can go, just Google it. I think I wrote an article called Experimentation on the Blacks. And I was able to trace it, you know, the Skinner method, and they taking all the grades away. They used the Black community throughout the country, inner city, to put in the school to work agenda, which, of course, follows the Soviet education in polytechnical education plan. Right. No grades. The Soviets probably have more academics than we do. But the Black community, the inner city community, I have grants that I brought out of the department where they even admitted that in the inner city communities, they may not have learned much, right? Dumbed down, they deliberately dumbed them down. But we did manage to restructure the system. Now, this is shocking. They use these innocent people, and the Blacks are very, I mean, I lived in the West Indies too for a while, Grenada. My husband was a yacht captain. We were down there for 5-6 years. And I really get along well with the Grenadians, and I've always gotten along very well with American Blacks, and I refuse to call them African Americans, right? I refuse to do that because they're Blacks, and they that's who they are, and I'm a white, they're Black. They've had more higher percentage fighting in our wars than any other group, dying for America. They're very patriotic. Nobody ever writes anything good about them, just bad. You know, you see about Chicago and Baltimore and all that mess. You do not see anything about the 90% of the American Black families that are trying to make a go of it, even though they've been used as guinea pigs. And they're religious people, and they're family-oriented, especially the mothers. Sometimes I don't have too much to say for the dads, but the mothers are fantastic, the grandmas. And I just think it's disgusting how the experimentation took place on our Black community in the United States in order to change the whole system to what we're looking at now, which is workforce training. Of course, they know that. They were slaves. I think they always smelled that rat, too. They know more about workforce training than anybody. So I think it's important to remember that. And so our country's just been so deliberately destroyed, you know, through these change agents all over. You know what we have in Maine? We have the headquarters in early 50s, the first national training laboratories, which came out of the OSS, and Kurt Lewin and all those change agents, was set up in Bethel, Maine. and it's still there. And that, I was really interested that I was in Brussels having lunch about 20 years ago with a friend of mine who worked for the Bank of Brussels. And I just written my little book, Back to Basics Reform, and I showed her it. And she said, oh, we have that in the bank. And so then I talked to her and she said that they had these training labs. Well, you have them all over Europe now. And they basically came from the initial pilot for the program was the National Training Laboratories in Bethel, Maine, where we used to ski up there. I mean, this all the stuff is in my books, but this is important because the original document, I remember showing it to Anthony Sutton, the original document, Kurt Lewin, and at the bottom of it, the first page, remember, it was legal size. It said that the methods that they were using were based on the communist Chinese group process. So everything we've been looking at is the group process.
You know, I think it's really, really important for people to hear someone with your experience, your age as well, to talk about the New World Order and these things, because most people nowadays think that the New World Order is just some, you know, current conspiracy theory that has just surfaced and so on, and do not see how long this plan has been in action and how dark this agenda really is. And I think it was in 1910 when there was a book written by the Carnegie Foundation, I think, where they were talking about war as a very effective way of changing a people. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I know that has been important in your life as well.
Well, that is very important. And I was fortunate enough to meet Robert Goldsboro, who's the author of, what's it called? Lines of Credit, Ropes of Bondage. I think people can find it on the internet. Lines of Credit, Ropes of Bondage. And through the author of this book, I met the research director for the Rees Committee for the investigation of the tax-exempt foundations in by Congress in 1953. I met Norman Dodd. And again, it was one of those experiences for little Charlotte in a restaurant in Georgetown, Washington. And he sat across from me and he told me the story about the investigation. And that he had been told he was working, he was a research director for the committee investigating the tax-exempt foundations. And in the process, he had to go to New York. And this is why it's not in the hearings. The hearings, the 3,000 page of the hearings are at my son's website, AmericanDeception.com. But this particular quote is not in the transcript of the hearings. There was only one copy left. I bought it from this gentleman who knew Norman Dodd. The foundations had, after the investigation was over, they went around the country and they either picked up or bought every single copy of the report of the committee. It's a 3,000 pager to scoop it up so the American people would never know what took place during that investigation. And this friend of mine who wrote the book I just mentioned, Lines of Credit, Ropes of Bondage, he had one copy. And he told me he had been offered any amount of money by one of the foundations for that one copy. And he turned them down. And then I think he may have had some, you know, we all have problems in our families financially or whatever. And he said, Charlotte, look, you're the only one I would let this go to. And I bought it for a pittance, like a penny a page. But anyway, during this investigation, and this is not in that transcript at my son's website, because the meeting took, it was off the record that Norman Dodd had with the president of the Ford Foundation, Rowan Gaither. And Mr. Gaither, basically, I'm sure that you can go again to your search the web for Edward Griffin's superb interview with Norman Dodd. All you have to do is type in Edward Griffin, Norman Dodd, right? And in that interview, Mr. Gaither, president of the Ford Foundation, told Norman Dodd that they, the foundations, tax-exempt foundations, we make them possible for them to exist, right? They got their instructions and had, ever since World War II, they got their instructions from the White House. And those instructions were to so alter life in the United States that it can be merged comfortably with the Soviet Union. That's a very important quote. And then, if you move on a little bit there, so I met him. And then in 1985, after I'd gotten myself fired from the office, you know, the U.S. Department of Ed, one of our wonderful researchers, she's Australian, she's now American, but probably the finest researcher I ever ran into, we used to call her Beth the Clipper, because she would clip all the newspapers around the world and get the best stuff out. So she found in the New York Times on page 38 or something, the fact that Ronald Reagan had signed the extensive United States-Soviet Educational and Cultural Exchange Agreement with Gorbachev, right? She found that. And then we all got on our horse, and that agreement is in my book. You can type this into the web too, folks. Just type Soviets in the classroom, America's latest education fad. That was a flyer that finally did get published and got out. But when we found out about that, we put a one-page ad, raised $5,000, you know, patriots across the country, to put a one-page ad in the Washington Times saying Edugate is more important than Watergate, because it was. And they used the schools to bring us down. And that makes sense, all through the brain, right? But anyway, so we're talking about Norman Dodd, the great Norman Dodd. And what happened? Well, of course, they had to have the phony fall in, what, 1990? And even Gorbachev, you know, it's really interesting for those Americans who really think communism is dead. I say, you know, we're not an ism form of government. No ism, thank you. No fascism, no socialism, no communism. We're not an ism form of government anyway. So when Gorbachev in London, in 2002, I think, he called the European Union the new European Soviet. And I thought at the time, well, everybody thinks that the Soviet Union is dead. Well, what if the European Union is the new European Soviet? I ask Americans this. I don't like to tell them anything. They don't like you to tell them anything. I say, what does that make the North American Union? And they go, ooh. Oh, North American Soviet. Okay, well, a Soviet is a region. I found years ago, a friend of mine in 1973, that's when I started another conservative group in Maine before the education one. And she sent me an article by a professor at the University of California, San Diego, a sociologist, Professor Zeitlin, in the Communist Daily World was published. And I've been getting that out ever since then. And that is certainly a reason why they hate Charlotte. That article, it's in my big book. Zeitlin says, he doesn't come right out and say regionalism is communism. But he's talking about how wonderful regionalism is and how it works so well in the Soviet Union. So I move a little bit further and I say, folks, regionalism, when they break down barriers, they get rid of elected officials, all this going on, they set up blue ribbon task forces, all the power is being taken from the people who ordinarily would vote in their local towns for certain people, certain issues. All that power has been taken from us through the regional government concept, which of course is UN Agenda 2030, is regionalism. And now I believe the prime major entity may well turn up to be the policing system. And I've written about that lately. People can go and Google me on and just type in community-oriented policing system. I had written about that in 2002, because I saw it in the town I lived in before in Bath, Maine, where the police were giving medals to people who did good deeds. The police decided what the good deeds were. That upset me because I was doing all this research on B.F. Skinner and the reward system, and I didn't like that. So I wrote a letter. So my name must have gone into their computer at that time. Also, in regard to the community-oriented policing system, I don't know what you call it in Europe. There is an article by a detective, Wortz, W-O-R-T-S, San Diego Police Department, California, written in 2002, and it's 10 pages. And Wortz is very intellectual in regard to the use of the Delphi technique and, you know, these different ways that bring us to group consensus on everything, just as Kurt Lewin said, right? But he says at the end that it's modeled on the East German Stasi policing system. And now what happens is this. I don't know why I always end up in these interesting places. And I could tell you a little bit about Grenada. That was interesting, too, because I saw before the revolution happened, I saw it all happening. And I told the Grenadians. But anyway, what happens with the community-oriented policing system, it comes right into my house. My son, when they tried to murder him, you know, I was just saying, he's amazing, he's alive. But anyway, in Portland, Maine, they have about 8 little community-oriented policing system groups. This is where you have the police and unelected citizens working together to make the community better, in quotes, take the problems in the community. Well, the one that is in his, where he lives, that little cops group, put out on the internet a week before the excellent police department report, but a week prior to it, they put out that, they didn't mention my son's name, but they said that an individual in the West End had shot himself in the leg. Uh-huh. Well, that story was the story of the guy who tried to murder my son, and we don't know whose directions he was under, but that was his story right from the beginning. He called the police department about 6-7 minutes after he left my son in a pool of blood. He called them and told them that story. Well, that story came out on the internet, public, lying story, 1 week or 10 days prior to the excellent, because there are a lot of great police still out there, folks. Please believe me. I know because I've been working with the enemy and our friends, right? And that police report, it did not say that my son had shot himself in the leg. It said that the suspect had committed, they didn't know exactly what had happened, but they said it was elevated, aggravated assault, and my son was a victim. So that's a big difference between the official police report, and I'm going after the cops now. That program, that group all around, I don't know what you call them in Europe, you probably got it, this community-oriented policing operation, which fortunately, I do believe our new Attorney General Sessions, I don't think he likes it. Actually, 4 years ago, the Congress voted to defund it. But it didn't go away because the Justice Department just took money out of their own account, and they have been pouring money into this community-oriented policing system. And I just want people to understand or ask themselves this question. How can this be constitutional? To have this group that has unelected people, carefully selected in the community, working with the police who are not elected either. It's a partnership. It's hardly public-private. It's sort of private-private. So this I am very concerned with. I say publicly that I really don't know that anything can be done to reverse the trends in education since Donald Trump came out in favor of the tax-funded school choice and charters and appointed Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, right? That was the final blow to our academic education system. So people who are trying now to do anything about it, I don't want to discourage them, but I personally feel it's more important to move on to the level in our community where if we speak out against anything, you know, any issue, care what it is, euthanasia, abortion, gun controls, whatever, you can answer that sentence with the community-oriented policing system. You're really going to be well off if you end up in jail and not dead. This is very serious, and I may be wrong. I mean, I do believe that the more I know, the less I know. But I feel that what the Dutch banker, spilling the beans, what he had to talk about, is number one priority. And number two is the community-oriented policing system, because no matter what issue we're all working on right now, and it's good that we are, and I'm totally supportive of people who are activists and everything, even, let's say, education. I'm not really working on education much anymore because I know in the future, not right now, it's not that bad right now, but if I go into, if my town, I live out in the country now, but so it made a difference, but in Portland where my son lived, if I had gone, or he had, as a taxpayer, gone to a community-oriented policing meeting and complained about something that wasn't politically correct, right? He's going to be in trouble. That's why all the work we do on the other issues is important, but the number one issue is to deal with their goal, which is to control you through the community-oriented policing system. If you don't have the right attitudes, globalism, you know, whatever, UN Agenda 2030, you know, it's up to you to figure out what they're going to do to you.
Listen, Charlotte, we've come to the end of the first hour, and I really want to thank you for taking the time. In the second hour, I would very much like to hear more about your life, the education around Reagan, and also the future, the way you see it. But here and now, how can people contact you or support you in what you try to accomplish?
Well, I think the best way to contact me is probably through my email. And that's dumbdown, D-U-M-B, you know, like everybody's so dumb. We all are. I'm dumb too, I think. The more you know, the dumber you realize you are. Okay. Dumbdown, D-U-M-B for Baker, D-Dog, O-W-N. Dumbdown, one word, lowercase. 00@yahoo.com.
And is there anything else people can do to support you in your efforts?
Well, it would be nice if everybody would write a letter. Oh my goodness, from abroad too, huh? Just write a nice letter to the judge at the municipal court, Cumberland County, Portland, Maine. I'll have to get the zip for you. And ask him to unlock the Dodge, Fred Dodge, the guy who tried to kill my son, the Dodge Iserbeat files. They have locked them. So nobody can see what's that. That is totally against freedom of the press. First Amendment case, right? They've locked that file. They don't want anybody to know what went on. In regard to the issue I just discussed, the two attempted murders of my son, who has the AmericanDeception.com website. If people would write the judge a very polite letter, just saying, we understand that the files have been locked, and we feel that under the First Amendment, this is unconstitutional, and these files should be opened for the public to know what happened.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, so all of us, please write to this address. I will put the whole complete address with the zip code underneath the interview. So please do that to support Charlotte for her brave dedication to the truth over so many years. Thank you, Charlotte, and we'll be back with the second hour soon.
Thank you.
To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe. Give yourself the gift of truth and awareness while supporting Ole's hard efforts to get it out there.
Coup d'etat in slow motion. Connecting the dots between the assassinations of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, JFK, Robert Kennedy, and John Lennon. Now available on Amazon and lightonconspiracies.com. Coup d'etat in slow motion.
May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.